Okay, Boker Tov, everyone here. La Mazinim also. What's that? Yeah, right. We read this week the Sedra of Chayesara. You didn't, Susan, come sit over here. Make it easier.
She has a back of cover.
Right, right.
Vayu
Chayesara, Me'ol Shana, V'Srim Shana, V'Sheva Shanim, Shnei Chayesara. The years, Sarah's life consisted of 100 years and 20 years and 7 years as well. So Rashi discusses the breakdown into years. We've discussed that in years past. I want to take up a little different area, which Rav Avinir mentions in his commentary on Chumash. He has an exhaustive commentary on Sefer Bereishis as opposed to Tal Chermon. Of course, we recognize that in the Pasuk, it ends Shnei Chayei Sarah, the years of the life of Sarah, which is a redundancy. Once you start Chayei Sarah, the life of Sarah, and then you break down each, Me'ol Shana, Srim Shana, Sheva Shanim, Shnei Chayei Sarah doesn't really play a role. So Shnei Chayei Sarah is redundant, and therefore has to come for a special purpose, to teach us something. And Arav says here that it does come to teach us something that we should all know, and that is the years of our lives are designated. A person is born, and he's given a certain lifespan. And that lifespan doesn't change. It's ketsuva. It's set. It's apportioned. It's allotted.
That's kind of depressing. I think that's exciting.
Okay, so we have one vote for exciting, one vote for depressing. Ah, the truth is reality can be both, but that's the reality. Now, it can change. I gave a shiur on this a year ago, based on the Gemara Yevamo stuff about Daf Mem Tes, that if a person sins, he could... it's actually machlokas in the Gemara. If he sins, he could lose time, and time is taken off. Whereas if he's virtuous, then he could have his years increased. But the other opinion says, no, you can only lose. That your time is your time. If you... lose, you lose, but you can't gain any more. In any event, that itself is a very critical understanding that our lifetime is fixed, and therefore shouldn't be wasted. Every opportunity, every day has to be exploited for some good purpose. I'm quoting Rav Avinair now, but it's based on Gemara. In Yevamos and elsewhere, he says that's why the phrase is repeated, Shnei Chayei Sarah. So just in context, in Rashi says the next pasuk that Avram came l'spod l'sarah v'livkosa v'nismecha misa sar l'akedas Yitzchak. The death of Sarah is juxtaposed to the binding of Yitzchak. L'fish ha'yidei b'sarah sarkeda shenizdamein b'na l'shchit v'kemat shelo nishchad. When Sarah heard the news of the Akedah, that her only son, her beloved son, was almost slaughtered, parcha nishma sami mena umesa. Then her soul just flew out of her, out of the shock, and she died. All right, so one would think from here that her life was cut short. So he says, no, the habre shluchim lamakom, God has many agents, many ways to accomplish a goal. It means her years were up, her life was up. But it just this was the causality of her death, and in fact, you could say it's also schus involved, that it just shows the bond that she had with Yitzchak that such a trauma would cause her immediate demise. Now, I was looking at this last night, and it just occurred to me that what's in the news the last few weeks is this woman, Brittany Maynard, suffering, Rahman al-San, from a brain tumor, who decided to kill herself on her own terms. Okay? And for the most part, the reaction is a positive one. You know, I didn't see any criticism. It's hard to criticize someone in that position in any event, but there was no broader philosophical understanding. We're in an era where the rights of the individual take precedence over anything else. And we control our lives, we control our fate. It's considered, in fact, a virtue to be the one who makes decisions in life. And to a large extent,
we take this argument a step further.
It is, but
that Hashem controlled when she's dying anyway.
causality was her killing herself.
So we'll get back to that point, right? You could say that also, right? You know, I'm destined to live a certain life, but if I jump in front of a truck, my life will end. And that's how it was. I should end my life like a fool, jumping in front of a truck.
Whatever it is.
Yes and no, but we'll say there is a notion that, like you see in the Gemara, a person can shorten his life also. But what's missing from the entire discussion? And again, I'm a little surprised, you know, the right to die has become a movement in America the last, I would say, 30, maybe now almost 40 years. At first, you all remember a Jack of Oregon. At first, it was held to be something that was beyond the pale. And like many things in the modern world, slowly it infiltrates until it becomes accepted, and then it reaches even a higher level where it's considered virtuous, laudable. And that's where she found herself, that the fact that she was in control would not let the disease kill her, but took, it was a brain tumor, but took her life really by the horns and said, the disease will not tell me when to die. I will tell myself when to die. So that was considered to be a very laudable act. Okay, and again, it's hard to criticize anybody in that predicament, or Rachman al-Islan, but it's not a very Jewish approach. Not Jewish? Hanesham Allah, Baguf Shalach. The soul is God's, the body is God's. We're really in His hands. It's His soul that He gave to us. It's not really ours. We hold it in trust. When He comes to take it from us, He takes it. Hashem nosan, Hashem lakach, Yishem Hashem evorach. God gives and God takes. May the name of God be blessed. Such a sentiment is not just completely absent from her particular case, but it's just absent from the entire worldview that is so prevalent in the world in which we live. So much so that we would think, oh, it seems to make sense. We pride ourselves on personal responsibility, my new book. We want to be able to make our decisions, to make good decisions. We do all the research. And so what's wrong with a person taking responsibility and not wanting to be a burden to others, not wanting to suffer? It's a plausible argument that can be made in favor of it, but not in terms of ultimate decisions. Ultimate decisions in terms of life. So suicide is just a person's desire to escape the fate that God has decreed, or escape responsibility for dealing with certain hardships that arise. And therefore, it's an un-Jewish approach. To me, it was just another example of how, I guess every generation lives through this, but how certain norms and certain values of the general culture are really the antithesis of the way Jews are supposed to look at the world, the values the Torah has given us. But getting back for a moment to the point that Naomi raised, Rav here asks a good question. He says, "Kevon shechayav shalom ktsuvim," since a person's lifespan is fixed, "Yishal ha-shoel," the questioner will ask, or ha-shoelet, in your case, "Mado lalechet larofei?" Why go to a doctor? Why do anything, in fact? If a person's going to die, he'll die with all the treatments that he gets. If he's not supposed to die, if his lifespan is fixed, so then why waste your time? Why burden the healthcare system with your presence if everything is fixed? And take it to a daily life. We're supposed to drive cautiously within the speed limit, all right? But why? If my lifespan is fixed, so I could drive fast, even recklessly, and live. If, God forbid, I kill someone,
smoke.
What?
I can smoke.
Smoke. If, God forbid, I kill someone, well, it's his time to go. It's the same thing about malpractice, right? A person dies because of medical malpractice. All right. You know, it's sad, but is the doctor to blame? No. The doctor, in his negligence, according to this thesis, was the instrumentality of the Malach HaMavos, like you said before, in order to effect this person's death. So he would have died in any event. If it was his time to go, it was his time to go. So how do we answer that? What is the answer? So there is an answer I gave years ago, and that is that it's not always so clear that the lifetime might be fixed, but nonetheless a person can shorten as well through foolish actions. But Rav Kedarka Bakodesh is a very concise answer. Ein larvev hashkacha Elohid umitzvot adam. We cannot commingle God's business and our business. Hashkachat Elokid, the way God supervises his world, the number of years and the type of life and the challenge he sends our way, that's his business. In the famous case of the Gemara Sanhedrin mentions, Chizkiah HaMelech did not want to have any children because he saw Baruch HaKodesh, he would have a son who's wicked. So he was punished with a life-threatening illness, and the Navi came to him, Yeshayo, and explained to him his theory, and the Navi said to him, as the Gemara says, why are you getting involved in God's secrets? God's secrets are what will be the fate of your children. But what is your obligation? To have the child. That's your obligation. What happens afterwards, that's already God's business. What's the mitzvat adam? Mitzvat adam is to live a normal life. A normal life. Protect yourself. Live within the laws of nature. Don't smoke. Don't drive recklessly, go to the physician, etc. That's our obligation. That's the obligation that's incumbent on every human being. The broader picture, the cosmic picture, the divine perspectives, it's a different cheshbon altogether. Yesh cheshbon enoshi, yesh cheshbon eloki. In terms of cheshbon enoshi, the human calculation, so we have all these obligations that are placed upon us. Those are the human obligations. In terms of how they fit into the general schemes, that's God's business, to which we have no knowledge. So since we have no knowledge of what the extent of our lifespan is, therefore a specific number should never enter into our calculations as to how we're going to live our lives or plan our lives. Rather, we have to maximize each day in Avodas Hashem. You wanted to ask something?
Yeah. I have a couple of questions. When I just
yes. Right.
I'm very confused about whether accidents are like outside of, I know Hashem knows what our life
right.
plan is, but is it always
right. So there's a stream
of
right, so what about the question, what about acts of war, terrorism, accidents, etc.? So there is a concept, there's a stream of thought that maintains, like the Gro maintained this, and many others as well, for all I know, could be the majority opinion, that there's such a thing known as the din prati and the din klali. There's an individual din, and there's a general din, all right? The individual prati is what's designated for this particular person in his or her life. But there's a din klali as well, because we exist in two realms. We exist in the realm of the individual, and we exist also in the realm of the tzibur, of the community. Okay? So is it possible, therefore, that a person would be destined, so to speak, for a life of, say, 90 years, but because he's ill-fated enough to be on a plane that crashes and he's age 60... will he be saved because he's supposed to live 90 years? No, not at all. That's the din klali. He suffers because of the fate of others. That's what we say in the Nesana Tokev, mi bekitzo, mi lo bekitzo. Some is in kates, apportioned time, and some not in his apportioned time. And it's the same thing with terror. I mean, the Gra held this, if he comments, on the Chazrei Milchama. You have the three sets of soldiers who don't have to go into battle. Person who's betrothed, not yet married, didn't build his home yet, person who built his house but didn't dedicate it, person who planted a vineyard, didn't consecrate it. In all the cases, he should go home and take care of that business, enjoy the fruits of his labor, so to speak. Pen yamus b'milchama, lest he die in battle. V'yishacher, yikachena, etc. And another person will marry his wife harvest his vineyard, etc.
It's just happened.
What did it just happen?
The Israeli army doesn't follow that.
No.
No, it's hard to say mechamis mitzvah you follow in any event. But what do you mean it just happened?
One of the young men, yeah, was that.
Oh, not one. I think there are half a dozen, unfortunately.
That was supposed to get married.
Yeah. I said it wasn't Arison yet, but nonetheless, yeah, it's very traumatic. It's very traumatic. Okay, so the girl asked a good question. So, Pen Yamus Muhamma, lest he die in battle, and someone else will take his place. Yeah, so going from the front to his home, he can't die. I mean, the truth is, it's safer to be at the front than to drive Israel's highways. So, in fact, it's not possible for a soldier to be killed, God forbid, on the way home from the front to his hometown, not in the least. And we'll say, well, this is the question of the Grah. If that's the case, so where's he running from? If it's his time to go, then he could leave the battlefield and still die. If it's not his time to go, then he should stay in battle and fight. So what's the chakira? It's a good question. It was your question also. You're like a female incarnation of the Gaon Mevilna.
Oh, my.
Alibi. So the Grah says, that's where he comes up with his the theory that din prati, din klali. In terms of prat,
he's the one that comes up.
I saw it in his writings, but I'm thinking it predates the girl. Also, mm-hmm. There is an individual judgment. That individual judgment can occasionally be subsumed by a communal judgment, in which you suffer that fate as well.
But is that to say that Hashem's plan for that individual person changed?
Yeah, I can't say it changed. Look, again, these are the secrets of God. We don't know how it operates, but, look, you say the Gemara...
Attention, or we just don't know it,
you can't know any specific case. You'll never know any specific case. The Gemara says, for example, when a young person dies, it's a Chil Hashem. All right? Michil Hashem. It's his world. Yes, it's Chil Hashem. Because that's not the way his world operates in a general sense. And it causes people to question, but nonetheless, it's the we can see the system, you know, in the abstract, in the macro. In every particular case, we're never able to say, "Oh, that's why he died." Yeah, of course, he was only destined to live this amount. We don't know. We don't know. We just don't know.
People often say that at a shiva house.
What's that?
People often make those remarks at a shiva house. You know,
yeah, people say
mace was
darndest things nifter. In the shiva house, yeah. Right?
better keep your mouth shut than say.
Yes, well, that's why that's halacha. You're not supposed to say anything until the Avil says something, because you know, I have compiled the list. I haven't published it yet, but people say the strangest things in a house of mourning because of the discomfort involved. You know, death awakens in all of us the most frightening emotions, and therefore we lose a certain filter. And the most common dynamic is for a person to say the wrong thing while attempting to say something comforting or the right thing. So it does happen. But here, you see, Rav Aviner distinguishes between the cheshbon eloki and the cheshbon enoshi, the two different sets of calculations. And all we are obligated to do is what we're obligated to do. And
could
we can't worry about what's that?
Sarah. So
he says that's
why she was destined to live a certain life.
And that's the point. No. There's no klal there. It's only an individual.
No, but what happened to Yitzchak was a general.
No, just family. You walked in right after I said this. That's why the pasuk ends Shnei Chaye Sarah with that redundancy. The years of the life of Sarah. Meyav Esrim Vesheva. Lo yom yoter, lo yom pachot. Not a day longer, not a day less, not a minute or second longer, or minute or second less. V'gam im lo hayta parachat nishmata b'shel akeda, harbe shluchim yesh lo makom. If it hadn't been that causality, it would have been some other causality. Harbe namerim, harbe nechashim, the many leopards, many snakes, many scorpions. So she died with the love of her mother, love of a mother for her son, as the last thing that she felt. From that perspective, not a bad way to go, filled with, overcome really, with love and concern for her child.
Is there a description of what it was? Was it her fear that he wouldn't go through the Akedah?
No, Rashi says that, and the Medrash elaborates, the Satan came and told her that Avram had slaughtered her son.
Right.
Rashi is a little more restrained. Shayidei besoras Akedah shenizdamein b'na l'shchito, through the news of the Akedah, that her son was brought to slaughter, v'kimat shelo nishchat. He just escaped, he averted the slaughter. The very thought, once it triggered, that she would lose her son, to whom she did not give birth till she was 90 years old, so that was enough, that trauma was enough to send her into shock.
But I think there's an alternative opinion that her
there are plenty?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. What's that? What's the alternative?
You know, that as I just said, that she was gripped by this fear that he wouldn't be able to fulfill.
Oh, that? Could be. I never heard that. Yes. Yes. Right. Pre-implementation genetic diagnostics. No, I haven't seen anyone who opposes that. Because it actually takes place before conception, not post-conception. So there's no mitzvah to have genetic diseases, I'll tell you that much. There's no mitzvah at all to have such a thing, so the more can be done. But that actually is a reflection of human ingenuity in trying to eradicate disease, which we're supposed to do. That's the intellect that he gave us. We're never completely in control, by the way, as we know, because there's always something new popping up to challenge us again, to keep our humility or our arrogance in check. But there's no doubt to have such a procedure available and to reduce the nature of disease. No, absolutely. I think that's another question, which is a prevalent one. You know, there's certain cases that arise, especially when fertility treatments are being conducted, and a woman will be carrying, say, 3 embryos, and the doctor recommends reducing by 1 in order to improve the viability of the 2. In other words, you could take a risk and all 3 won't live, or this will greatly increase the probability that 2 will be healthy. So what do you do in such a case? So you see, many people can say it's mutter to do.
Because it's considered a
rodif? Exactly, because the one is a rodif against the other two. The question is, and this is what's always the confounding element, who is the rodif?
Right.
Who is the rodif? Right.
Any, many, many, many.
Right. But Reb Shlomo Zalman discussed it at length. So
really?
Such a thing does exist in our world. It makes sense.
What was his exact?
I think it says mutter to do, because otherwise they're all going to die, or they all have a lesser probability of living. Yeah, I think so. They're definitely those who are mutter. I dealt with the shayla in the past. Okay, so that's shnei chayei sarah, and here this besora is what Rashi says caused Sarah's life to have its abrupt ending. Now that raised another issue that I want to discuss also. And that's from the Sichas Musar of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, who was the venerable Rosh Yeshiva of Mir in Europe, and then Shanghai, then Yerushalayim. Sichas Musar is, as it sounds, Musar conversations. He extracts some Musar ideas from every Sedra. And here in this Sedra, he talks about Midat HaHistaglut, the trait of, I guess the best way to say it would be, adaptation or adaptability. So he says, for example, I mean, why did Sarah have to die? Why couldn't she just hear what was said? He was almost killed, and but he wasn't, all right? So why should that have sent her over the brink? The fact is, Avram was the one who actually did it. Didn't send him over the edge. So why was Sarah sent over the edge? So he explains that, especially since Sarah was greater in Nevuah than Avram was, so why would she not be able to assimilate this image or this vision or this report and you know, be traumatized by it, but live, not parcha nishmasov. So he says, you know, notice that when it came to the Akedah, God broke the news to Avram very gently. Okay? God said to Avram, Vayomer Elov, Vayomer kach nos bincho es yichicho asher ahavto es yitzchok. The three stages leading up to the identification of the victim here as Yitzchak. Kachnos bincho means your son. So now Avram was able to think, all right, something's happened to one of my sons. He doesn't know yet what is happening, but something will, so he's acquainted. Yichidcho, your only sons, you have two, one from each mother. Asher ahavto, I love both. And only then Yitzchak. Meaning the news was shared with Avram slowly, so la'at la'at he'd be able to internalize what's happening. Now that he knew at the end, after, again, slowly, it led up to Yitzchak, then when he was told, v'lech l'chol eretz ha'moriyah, v'aleh l'sham le'olah, then he was able already to move forward, because the sense of the shock had dissipated. Sarah wasn't like that. Sarah was told, that's it. He was almost killed. Not with any mitigating language, not with any introduction, just like the harshness of the news, all right? It's like getting a phone call, he's dead, that's it. Sometimes an older person, we just had this case recently, an older person dies, and they're alone, and you send someone to them. Don't tell them over the phone. You send a friend or a close relative to break the news to them gently, especially if it's something that happens suddenly or abruptly. If you say something quickly, like a hammer over the head, that's much more difficult to digest, and people then recoil. People could faint. It's happened also. They faint when they hear the news. There's a way to do it slowly. In fact, he doesn't mention this, but you see this in the Torah. The story of Yaakov and Yosef is really bookended by that type of approach. The brothers came back to Yaakov, and they didn't say that Yosef was killed. What did they say to him? No, they didn't say that either. They brought him back the ksones.
They said, look what we found.
And they didn't even come. They sent it with someone, and they said, Zos Matsana, we found this. So already he sees something, and already that he knows something is off. And then he says, Hakerno, do you recognize this? Haksonas ben Chohim lo, is this the tunic of your son or not? And then he said, and he made the deduction, they never told him, Ksonas bini, indeed. It's the tunic of my son, Chaya Ro'o Acholosu Tarof Tarof Yosef. So he reacted, but he reacted after the second or third stimulus, not the first. Had they just come and told him, which they didn't want to do, but had they just come and told him, Yosef is dead, then who knows what type of reaction he would have had.
But then again, they didn't really know Yosef was dead.
Oh, well, they knew he wasn't dead. They knew he was not dead. But so, the simplest thing would be to say, oh, we found this, Yosef, he's dead, all right, chaval, let's move on. They didn't say that. They wanted to break it to him slowly. Now, at the end of the story, the bookend, is when he was told that Yosef was alive. All right? What happened? See, Rashi quotes it here. Mount Sinai Rashi, the Medrash.
Was it Od Yosef
Chaim or something? Yeah. Rav, Od Yosef, what? They came to him and they said, O Yosef Chai, v'chihu Moshel b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. So who was it? The Medrash says it was Serach Bas Asher, who was tending to him. And she found out, they told her to tell him, and then she broke the news to him slowly, all right? Something, singing a harp, I remember that.
Standing behind him and singing.
Right. And then, so he heard that, and the Torah says, Vayafag libo, ki lohem in lohem. What does that mean? His heart skipped a beat. You see, in the worst case scenario, Sarah, parcha nishmasa. Yaakov, vayafag libo. But vayafag libo, because, again, even this good news was not thrust upon him suddenly. It was rather given to him very gently. if he'd be able to assimilate it. That wasn't done here. He was not done with Sarah. It was her time to go. In any event, the broader point that has to be made, that Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz wants to make here, is that this quality of histaglut, of adaptability, is very human. It has positive aspects to it, and it has negative aspects to it as well. The fact is, when it came to Avram, his mind was not set to flutter. He didn't lose his capacity for reason, the decision-making as a result. Gilola Hashem et ha-davar tipin tipin, slowly, drop by drop, he was told about the event. Not so Sarah. Now he says, you have a similar story in the Gemara in Ksuvos, from Chanan ben Chachinai, who went out, left, I guess it was their custom then, Rabbi Kiva was the same thing, left home to learn Torah for 12 years. All right? And then he came home suddenly, surprised his wife, probably for away for 12 years, a surprise, not the best way to go about it, but surprised his wife, walked in, she was busy with her housework, she lifted her eyes, she was stunned, startled to see him, and her soul left her. Rashi says, suddenly she says, this is her husband, and nothing made sense. Okay? Before she fully understood why he's there, what's he doing there, why is he back, even fully who he is, it was too late, she was gone already. You have a more telling case that really he makes this point quite well as to the negative aspects of adaptability with which Jews are quite familiar from the story of Chushim ben Don. Chushim, the son of Don, in the Gemara Sota, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, when they buried Yaakov at the Marsa Machpelah. The Gemara tells a story that they came to bury Yaakov in the Marsa Machpelah, and And Esav came to protest, saying that he's the Bechor, and the Marsa Machpelah really belongs to him. And Yaakov has no right to be buried there. And they're arguing with Esav, the other sons are arguing back and forth. And Esav said he wants to see the Shtar Mechira that was sold to Yaakov. So they said, we left it back in Egypt. And they dispatched Naftali Ayelah Shulcha, he was quite swift, he's a marathoner. They sent him to run back to Egypt to not like that to from Hebron to Egypt to retrieve the shtar. In the meantime, Yaakov is just in his coffin, lying there. Chushim ben Don, Gumar tells us, as his name implies, was hard of hearing, was deaf, so he didn't know what was going on. All he saw was that Yaakov was not being buried. He saw this whole fight going on. And he asked what happened, and they explained to him, that sign language, explained to him what's happening. So he said, "Va'ada osi Naftali me'arda mitzrayim hey avi abu mutal b'vizayon." You're trying to tell me that until Naftali comes back from Egypt, my grandfather has to lie there in disgrace, unburied? Shokal kolfo machiyei reshe. He took an axe and he chopped off Esav's head. And Esav's head rolled Mara, and that fulfilled the unfortunate Vua of Rivka Imenu, that she'd lose her two sons in the same day. But nonetheless, then they buried Yaakov. So the question that he asks is, what happened to Chushim ben Don that didn't happen to the others? I mean, why was Yaakov's honor more precious to Chushim ben Don than to the other children or grandchildren? Why was he the one to take this action and kill Esau? If they're going to do that, they could have done it before the whole discussion started. So he explains that everyone else, all the sons and all the other grandchildren, they heard Esau's complaint and they started to dialogue, they started to negotiate, they're trying to find a way out of it. And meanwhile, Yaakov is lying there and they're talking. And as they talk, maybe they saw he has a legitimate point, wanted to prove themselves that they were the ones who were correct, he was wrong, but the sense of horror left them. the sense that Yaakov is mutal bibizoyon did not exist. Mm-hmm. It receded. The emotional impact receded. And once it receded, they could not act, as opposed to Chushim ben Dan. He couldn't hear the whole negotiations. He didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. All he saw was, to him, a tremendous avla, the disrespect shown to his grandfather. So he reacted viscerally in a way that the others could not. That's histaglut. Histaglut enables us to deal with tragedy. It also enables us to become too accommodating to evil as well. We just accept too much. We adapt too much. Part of the problem of Jewish life in the last, let me say it a different way, part of the strength of the Jewish people in the last 2,000 years of exile has been our ability to adapt to the harshest environments in which we found ourselves. Part of the problem of Jewish life in the last 2,000 years has been the extent to which we are able to adapt ourselves to all the tsaras that surrounded us. So that when each tsara was imposed on us, it seemed bad, but then we got used to it. The Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, exploited this to the hilt. The first measures were taken were relative, again, compared to the outcome, relatively mild. You had to wear a yellow star. You lost certain civil rights, education, business, citizenship, etc. It seemed terrible at the outset, because it was terrible. It was insulting and repugnant and something that was made to induce in a Jew feelings of inferiority. But what happened? They got used to it. They began to adapt. They went into other businesses. They did other things. And then when the war started, the ghettos began. And they adapted to that also. And even the camps, they adapted. Whatever happened, Jews adapt. Well, you think it don't end with the Holocaust. It's not true. It's not true. That's the last 30 years of our history in Israel. Okay, when the war for the land of Israel started in the late 1980s, it started with rocks and stones. All right? They would stone cars. And what happened? Well, there was a response, a tepid response, but it didn't seem to be a threat to the nation. It wasn't an existential threat. So they adapted to it. What's the nature of the adaptation? You don't travel on that road, right? Don't go through Wadi Joe's.
They built a fence.
That was the next stage. First, they said, don't go on that road, you'll be okay. They could, them throw whatever they want. Yeah. Well, we could adjust to that.
And then they build tunnels.
Tunnels, that's a later stage, but here's the point. They went from that, not responding to the first threat. What then became the second threat? Well, that became bombs. And then suicide bombs.
Well, what's the alternative?
The alternative is to crush the rebellion in its infancy.
Crush them.
Exactly.
What
Shamir had said this when he was prime minister. He wasn't prime minister at the time, although he responded forcefully. When he was prime minister, and then it did peter out by the time Oslo came in 1993, but he said, had you killed a few hundred in 1987, December 87, when the first rebellion broke out, it would have ended. Yeah, you would have had bad publicity for a week or two. It would have ended, okay? So now, like you said, what became the next stage? Oh, they're sending suicide bombers? We'll build a fence. They're shooting rockets? We'll build a dome, all right? Everything is defensive. Everything is reactive.
Yeah.
Very little is offensive and proactive. That is the nature of histaglut. You just adapt to whatever comes your way. And now we're back to almost square one. Rechamon Atzlan, another soldier, was stabbed this morning. He's in critical condition at the train station in Tel Aviv. And Avram Shechem took out a knife and just started stabbing him multiple times in the torso. He's in critical condition. And he was apprehended also. But like the chief inspector said, it was either yesterday or Friday, he said, as far as he's concerned, it's an impolitic statement, I'm sure they'll delete it quickly, every Arab with a car is a suspect, a terrorist. And now every Arab who walks the streets who may be carrying a knife is a suspected terrorist. So you can be in a situation, you adapt to that also. don't take the light rail, don't stand in front of the light, don't stand in front of the buses, don't stand in front of the train. But you can't live like that. Far better than just adapting to everything bad that is sent our way to take action against it, all right? And action sometimes is harsh, but if people demonstrate that they are not fit to live in civilized society, they should be treated like others who are not fit to live in civilized society, to wit, wild animals that we keep in zoos and not where the people are. So if you can't have a zoo, they should find their fortune elsewhere.
I think we're insulting wild animals.
You think what?
We're insulting animals.
We're insulting animals, all right. Oh, you're much more harsh than I am. The bottom line is that we adapt. You know, it reminds me, there's a famous scientific test called the Chicago Experiment. Have you heard of that? Early 60s. Very famous. You take a frog and throw it in a pot of boiling water, and the frog jumps out. You take a frog and put it in a pot of lukewarm water, he starts swimming around. You keep turning up the heat, and within a few minutes he's dead. He doesn't jump out because he adapts to the water. That's the nature of Klal Yisrael. In ancient times, certainly during the Holocaust, today as well, each stage we adapt. So midat istaglut hazo atfu'a b'nafsho shel adam. It's really part of, it's an innate part of our being, how we look at the world. So it does help us. It does help us in dealing with tragedy. By the same token, it also sometimes gives us the capacity to avoid dealing with the suffering, to be much too accommodating to suffering, because we say, I can handle this. At the end of the day, how much can we handle? We really can handle a lot. We really can. Doesn't mean we have to, but we really can handle a lot. And each time we're sent nisyonos, you know, if you would take a person on day one, and let's say, God forbid, there's a terrible year ahead of them. If you would tell them on day one, at the end of this year, you're going to have five different sorrows that may overwhelm you, so he will be overwhelmed by it. But then each one, God forbid, comes along, and we find that we have the inner strength to deal with it, and that really is the adaptability, which is part of human nature. On the other hand, to say that, you know, bring it on, I can handle it, that also makes no sense, because you want to try to avoid harmful situations as much as possible. So he says, sometimes this midav histaglut, yeshi lo lira'atz, it becomes an obstacle. It becomes a stumbling block. A stumbling block when it causes our enthusiasm for something to wane. All right, it causes our passions to enervate, because we become accustomed to it. So again, you have the negative things, the sorrows, and you have the positive things as well. Let's say there's a project that you undertake, and you're very excited by it, right? But what's histaglut? The excitement doesn't last forever. I mean, people will say marriage is like that. Also, marriages also go through, you know, there's an initial passion, and then it also can wane, and then it has to be reignited. Parenting is not really like that, you know? That's really the exception, that you never hear someone say, like a mother never says, you know what, I'm tired of these kids. I'm out. No, they'll say it, they'll even mean it, but it'll last like a minute or two, until the next time the child comes with plaintive eyes and asks something of the mother. So the sentiment will be there, but it won't be acted upon. In almost every other sphere, it's acted upon. He's talking in... What's that?
I said people keep having more children.
So they should have the initial excitement. Right. A different type of excitement comes along. But anything, a person always needs reinforcement to make sure that our moral level remains constant, if not increases, that our commitment remains constant. So a very good case here. Gemara tells a story. It's in Sanhedrin, Daf Yotes Amud Beis, of Palti ben Laish. So after this, Shmuel Aleph, after the story of David and Novel and Avigail, so he marries Avigail, and then there's a pasuk appended to the perek. Shaul HaMelech gave his daughter Michal to gave his daughter Michal to Palti ben Laish as a wife. Now Michal had already been given to David as a wife. Okay, so the Gemara says that Right, you know, they were already on the outs, Shaul and David, and Shaul maintained that their kiddushin wasn't good, and therefore she wasn't really married to David, and he could stick it to David to give Michal to another man. So she became the wife of Palti ben Laish. So the Gemara says Ksif Palti. Here in Shmuel Aleph he's called Palti. In Shmuel Beis it's called Paltiel. Palti means escape, rescue. Paltiel, God rescued him, as opposed to Palti ben Laish. Omrav Yehuda Palti Shmo, Omrav Yochanan Palti Shmo Velomenikra Paltiel Shepilato El Min Havera. He was called Paltiel because God saved him from sin, meaning he married Michal, but they never lived together, they never had relations. Palti lo Meosa No Atzcherev Beino Leveino. He stuck a sword between in the bed between the two of them. Omar Whoever is involved in that, marital relations with her, meaning himself, should be stabbed with his sword. And that became a constant reminder. And you know, he is held to be an exemplar of humility and self-control, restraint. The fact that he was together with Michal, however long they were married, and they never had relations, because he maintained she was still married to David, as opposed to Beis Dino Shel Shol. See, why did he marry her? I mean, the king said, you have to, here's my daughter, you can't say no to the king. He'd be killed for that also. Anvisanusa Shel Palti Ben Laish, the Gemara extols his self-restraint, his humility, his self-abnegation. So here's the thing. So Rav Shmuel Levitz asked this question. He says that this was superhuman self-discipline, self-control on his part. So what then does the Gemara mean that he was called Paltiel Shepilato El Min Avera, that God saved him from sin? It's not that God saved him from sin, it's just he had this extraordinary self-control. He saved himself from sin and placed the sword there as a constant reminder. So why is he called Paltiel? See, he said that if not for the fact that God helped him, he would not have been able to withstand night after night, month after month, year after year, ulitgaber al yitzro zman kam mushach, to be able to overcome his yetzer hara for that extended period of time. He needed divine assistance. Of course, ein adam zocheh l'neis, elam kein asat shelo, l'shmartzum menachet. No one merits a miracle unless he does the first act, something to save himself from sin. But the fact is, he needed that reminder. Why? Because of his staglut. You're filled with righteous indignation at being in this situation. You're filled with a sense of the utmost morality, a very, very acute moral sense that you're not going to sin with this particular woman. It's Yosef and Potiphar's wife, but on a scale that lasts years, not just a brief encounter. What usually happens? You more hetter to yourself. You start telling yourself, not so bad. Maybe Shaul is right. Maybe I'm wrong. Why am I being so frum? I'm being so charedi. What am I, woman? What try to impress? Everyone says it's mutter. I have to be machmir for myself. No. The fact that he was able to withstand that and not give in to that midat istaglut, that showed his greatness as well. See, it works from two different angles. There's sometimes that we have something good that we want to do, something noble, and we start out with a lot of enthusiasm, and then adaptability sets in, and you can't sustain it, and we lose the momentum, lose focus. That's a bad type of histaglut. There's another type of bad histaglut, like I mentioned, when and suffering is imposed on us by our enemies. And we say, all right, Adkan, we can accept this and no more. And then more comes, and we say, okay, now Adkan, until here and no more. And we just keep moving the bar, and that's also unhealthy. And there's a positive type of histaglut as well that enables us, when we're confronted with a situation that's beyond our control, to summon up inner resources and say, if this is what life has given me, this is what I can accept. And on this will be my foundation. I guess said another way, if this is the deck of cards I'm dealt, this is what I have to play with. And I'll make my way in life with this deck. So he ends by saying here that the Akedah was a Nisayon that God gave Avram Avinu. With the Nisayon, he gave Avram the Koach Lamod Bo, the strength to withstand it. Lumat Zot, Sarah, Shaloni Tano Nisayon Zeh, Sarah was not given the Nisayon of the Akedah. Why not? She couldn't have done it. A mother's different. Could not have done it. So she did not have the Nisayon. Because she did not have the Nisayon, Lo Nitan LaKoch Lamod Bo, nor did she have the strength to withstand it, even though she was great in Nevuah. And that's when she heard about it. She could not assimilate that. It so completely shook her worldview that, as Rashi says here, according to the Medrash, her life ended on that note, filled with love and worry for her son. All right, that's his staglut, and that is Parshas Chayesara. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Yes. A test? So the question, well, I have to just repeat it. The question was, if God gave Avram strength to withstand the Nisayon, how's the Nisayon? Because Avram didn't know he had the strength until afterwards. That's the famous Ramban. Ramban says a similar thing in the Morah. But the Ramban says that a Nisayon is given to us, lotzi men hakoach el hapoel, to take something that's in potentia and make it actual. Avram knew potentially he had this commitment, this self-sacrifice. Obviously he knew it, but it was never acted upon. It's when you act upon it, then you see that you really can do it. It was never demanded of him. That's the test. Yes. Right. No, it just Vayomer Hashem el Avram Lech Lecha Vayomer Elav Kach Nos Bincha. I mean, the nature of the we know it was not like Nevuas Moshe. It was in a vision. It was in a mara, a vision, a dreamlike state. But nonetheless, it was real. No, he was not awake. But it was real, though. In fact, we'll discuss tonight in the class in Amunah that the Rambam says that that's the linkage between the Akedah and Har Sinai. That you see, a Nevuah is so real, so tangible, that even when one was asleep in a dream, it felt real. Otherwise, Avram could not have responded to what might have been a hallucination that God told him to kill his son.
I was just wondering, like,
and what happened to Avram as an individual, it happened to us as a nation. That type of tangibility.
But I'm thinking about how Sarah's react. Like you said, Avram was told solely. Like, so if he was told solely in a dream about, like, hey, that was.
Well, you do have the Gemara say that, in fact, the Jewish people pleaded with Moshe after the second Dibra, Va'atada Bereleinu, you speak to us. Toshash Kochem Kinekeva, they became weak because they felt their humanity leaving them, the reality of God's presence being so pervasive. So, in fact, I think it could be, if I remember correctly, a similar phrase is used, if not Parchon Nishmasam, but something similar to that. Let me see if I can find the pasuk. I think it's in Parshas Ekev. No, it's Parshas Vaschanan. The pasuk says, "It's Perak He Pasuk Chaf Dalid Ki Mi Chol Basar Asher Shema Kol Elokim Chayim Yidaber Mitoch HaEish Kamon VaYechi Krav Atah Ushema Eis Kol Asher Yomar Hashem Elokeinu Va'at Daber Eleinu Eis Kol Asher Yidaber Hashem Elokeinu Lecha V'Shamanu V'Asinu." So Rashi says he's Tashmas Kochik and Akel. You made Moshe weak. That's a little different context. Moshe became weak. But
does he use that phrase?
He touched him as Kochik and Akel, right. Right. Don't take it personally. Shinitzaarti Alechem, Urfisa Mesyodi, that you I became aggrieved because of you, and you weakened my hand. I see you're not as zealous enough to draw near to God out of love. Isn't it, would it have been better to learn directly from God, to hear God say, Lo tirtza, kaves avicho, etc., than to hear it from me? But no, they couldn't. Yeah. Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes. Well, she didn't hear from God. Right.
So I'm just saying, like,
right. By the way, you should know, so the Medrash says that it was Satan who came. But Satan can take many guises. Satan can be a nosy neighbor also, who said, you know, who heard, hey, you know, Abe, you know where he's been? Your husband, A.B.? He's went to Cleo's son. And she couldn't take it. Very slowly, correct, gently. That's
also, like,
that's
know,
right. That was the first point.
It's like different than like a shock.
Of course, sure.
Oh, I see. Because it was Bimara, right? Could be.
I have a question. I read an article where someone was questioning that Abraham questioned God's intent to kill the people of Sodom, and he was arguing with Hashem. So the person was questioning, well, why didn't he argue with Hashem about this whole?
Right. Yeah, it's a famous question. You see, Avram didn't really argue with God over the fate of Sodom. All he argued with God over was in trying to understand God's system of justice. That's it. You know, he was asking God, explain to him that how is it that an entire society can be killed? Like, what's the benefit in terms of God's perspective on the world in killing an entire society? And that's what he came up with this theory that if society has 50 tzaddikim, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, then maybe something can be salvaged. That was a theory. So it wasn't pleading for Sodom like a defense attorney saying, oh, they're really not bad, or there's extenuating circumstances. He's trying to understand how God runs the world. In fact, that's how God introduced it as well. Ha-mechassani ma'avram, eisashi aniyosa. Should I hide from Avram that which I'm doing? Right? Why would we think that God owes Avram an explanation? So the Torah goes on to say, the very next pasuk, it's because the Avram, yeah, Vashem Amar, Hamechasenim Avram Asher Nioseh, Vavram Hayo Yeh Legoy Gadol Vatsum, Venivruchu Vokol Goyarts, Avram's going to be a great nation, everyone will be blessed through him, Ki Yedativ Leman Asher Yitzavez Bonavis Beisav Acharav, Vishram Derech Hashem, Lasas Dokal Mishpat. If Avram's going to have a family that's going to be premised on Tzedakah Mishpat and Derech Hashem, he has to know what Derech Hashem is. So that's why God sent Avram, told him that he's going to destroy Sodom, and then he asked, where's the justice in this? Ha'af tispet tzaddikim rasho. He wasn't pleading for their salvation. He was trying to understand why God would do it, and that understanding he came away with. Yitzchak was a different issue. That Medrash says he could have had tainus also. God, you told me Kibi Yitzchak Kira L'Chazara, and the Yitzchak, the son, etc., etc. But he didn't. That's his greatness.
That's a good question. Why didn't he argue with God?
That's his greatness, right? That's it, because he was makabel God's judgment. That's why. Yeah. It's interesting that in our world we think that arguing with God is a higher level than just accepting God's decree. All right? Maybe it's the opposite.
I would think it's the opposite. It's only because he argued for Sodom, and that Sodom, not his own kid. That's why you question.
Right, so he's not arguing for Sodom, he's arguing about Sodom.
Okay.
That's a little different, right. But nonetheless, the question still remains. Why didn't he, forget Sodom, why didn't he argue on behalf of Yitzhak? All right? Because he's makabel God's gzeira. That's why. That acceptance of God's decree to us is a value. It may not be a value anymore today, but to us it is a value historically. Okay, thank you all very much.